You're in fellowship and continue on here. We're actually now back to the text. I know you thought we never would be, but we are. Dealing with the first part of chapter 5, which is the first, well, not the first, but certainly a general section in the first seven verses, in which Solomon actually, we get to hear the older Solomon actually offering advice to his younger audience. Again, the background of this book is that Solomon is writing primarily to a younger audience. He is an old guy who's been through it all, has seen it all, has seen way more than he wants to, in fact. In fact, is probably a little jaded, but, you know, if you had 700 wives, you might be too. I don't know. Three would be enough, I would think. But he's a little jaded. He's had all the money, all the time, to do everything he wanted to do. He pursued everything to the nth degree. He didn't do anything halfway. He has tried everything at a certain point to make himself happy, and he found out that he wasn't happy at the end of the day. With all his money, with all his... And Solomon was the most notorious character of his generation. I mean, he was known all over the world. The fleeting nature of fame, the fleeting nature of everything was what impressed him. And that is, in a sense, the theme of the whole book, the fleeting nature of everything. Everything passes. Everything comes and everything goes. You're young once, then you get old, and then you die. That's the gist of it. And on the trip, is there any fun to be had? Well, some people say, well, yeah, you pursue fun. That's how you have fun. Solomon pursued fun, and he found out it wasn't fun, which is an irony, of course, but he pursued money, found out money didn't make him happy. He pursued women, found out women didn't make him happy. Some people think, oh, if I just had enough women, I'd be happy. Well, believe me, one's enough. If one may be too many some days. You just never know. And so Solomon does everything he wants to do. He has no one to check him. He has unlimited power. He has no one to answer to other than God himself. And in a sense, he had quit answering to God in his life. And he just did what he wanted. And this brought him to a point where he was very unhappy. He just wasn't happy with it all. And so when he set about to be happy, he found out that I can't be happy. This doesn't make me happy. No matter what I do, it doesn't make me happy. And so where is there any happiness to be had in this life kind of becomes one of the questions. And this old guy is now offering advice. And he tells you throughout this book, he doesn't tell you when he's, as it were, we might say, changing characters. But you're hearing in this book, and this is one of the things, if you do any serious study of the book, read any serious commentaries on the book, you will find that people think this is a number of authors. One of the common interpretations of this book is it's not written by just one guy, it's written by 4 or 5 or 10. But what you're hearing is the voice of Solomon at different points in his life. And at the end of it all, you're hearing the old wise Solomon talk, but not all the time in this book. And that's why the interpretation becomes difficult. Does Solomon, you might say, well, okay, and he said, I saw thus and such, and I thought thus and such. Okay, do you still think that now? He doesn't tell you. He doesn't tell you whether or not he still thinks it now. He just tells you about it, tells you his view of it at that time, and then moves on. And the older, wiser Solomon here, the last voice we hear, actually the first seven verses of chapter 5, 1 through 7, is him offering advice. And it's interesting in that this book is not preachy. One of the quickest ways to turn off young people is to start preaching to them. Start telling them how to do it. Solomon doesn't do that. He takes the complete opposite approach. He does offer advice from time to time, and that's why we have these, like the first seven verses here, there are many imperatival constructions in here. Either imperatives or adjusives, which is essentially a Hebrew command. And but he doesn't do that very often throughout this book. He doesn't offer what we might call a lot of advice. He just talks about the world that he's seen, the world that he lives in, how he feels about it, and then he lets the reader draw his own conclusion. And in some cases, he doesn't necessarily even tell you logically what to think. He just lets you think through it for yourself. And so one of the things we see here is he'll offer some proverbs. Now, one of the things you find out about proverbs is proverbs are generally true. But that's it. That's the thing you have to draw the line at, is the proverbs are not true on every occasion and at every time. But they're generally true. If you look around in the world, we can say certain things we see, we recognize happen, this is good. Like, for instance, in chapter 4, you see, two are better than one because they can get more accomplished. Okay, well, who's going to argue with that? Nobody. Generally speaking, two are better than one. But if you put two nincompoops on a job, are two any better than one? Probably not. So you see, they're not always true at all times, but they're generally true. And then part of Solomon's frustration is that he looks around and he's seen this wisdom mentality that existed in Israel. And he was a wise man himself. He was not a fool. Solomon was very smart. And he looked around and he said, you know, these things, it's not always true that the race goes to the fastest. You know? But generally speaking, there was a proverb. You know, the old story of the tortoise and the hare. That violates the proverb, that story, that the race goes to the quickest. It's not always the quickest that wins. And Solomon has seen this. And he has seen that the world is filled with inconsistencies. He has seen that the world is filled with injustice. Now, he's the king. Why doesn't he go about fixing it? He can't even fix it all. He's got unlimited power, and he can't fix it all. Solomon answered, again, to no one. If you understand the Oriental monarchy, Nebuchadnezzar was the most powerful man that ever lived on the planet. By any stretch of the imagination. Concentrated power was in that man. He answered to nobody. And if you go and you read the book of Daniel, you'll see that. He is the head of gold. That he was the epitome of an earthly king. Now, he was negative and he was an unbeliever at the time. He ultimately got saved, of course. We know that. He was positive. And at the end of the day, he finally believed. But Nebuchadnezzar and Solomon were probably two of the most powerful characters that ever lived on the planet. They answered to nobody. And so even with all of this, Solomon looks around at the world and he says, you know, it's just not what I expected. And underneath all of this, underneath all this writing, there lies the reality of the fall of man and sinfulness. He doesn't ever really address it. But he knows it's there, that the world is a very imperfect place. The world is not, if you knew anything about God, see, some of us tried to do this, they've tried to take this tack at the book and say, well, Solomon's writing as though he was an unbeliever. No, he's not. That, if you've heard that, throw that out. That is stupid and wrong. Because he uses the word God something like 40 times in this book. So we know he knows about God. And we know that he understands certain things about God, and the sovereignty of God, he recognizes, rules over everything. And yet the world still isn't what it should be. Why not? Well, behind all that is the reality of sin and the fall. And my feeling is that Solomon either had been or was doing a pretty serious study of Genesis, either while he was writing this or before he wrote this. Because you go back and you look, and again, you'll see many of the truths in Genesis reiterated in this book. And while Solomon never says anything about faith in this book, the word, there's no deal about believing. There's nothing about salvation to speak of. There's nothing about phase two faith. Underneath all of it, ultimately, he knows, and if you read the book carefully, that the reality is you have to live by faith. That this world, if you live in this world and you focus on this world exclusively, you're going to be very disappointed. It is going to be one big letdown. And so Solomon sees all this. And he's seen all of it. And he's experienced it. And there was a period, of course, we might say, where Solomon was a reversionist. He blew off God's plan at a certain level. And he went out and did it his way. And even during that time, of course, he didn't abandon his faith. But now he's old and he's facing his mortality. Who's the most scary guy in the world? The person that knows they're going to die. Because they've got nothing to lose. They know that they're going to lose it all. And he has bemoaned that fact through the first five chapters, big time, first four chapters. Certainly chapter 2 was loaded with it. I'm going to die. At the end of the day, Whether you're righteous or whether you're wicked, you're going to die. At the end of the day, whether you're a wise man or whether you're a fool, you're going to die. At the end of the day, whether you're rich or whether you're poor, you're going to die. And so I those of you who've been here, the first two chapters aren't particularly uplifting. It's life sucks and then you die. There you go. That's your doctrine. Now, does Solomon really believe that becomes the question. Some say, well, yeah, he really believed that. I don't think he did. But I think he's challenging his audience to think about this without, quote, preaching to them. He's challenging them to think, what do you believe about life? For instance, he says back in chapter 3, look at this. What do you believe about this? The fate, verse 19, the fate of the sons of men and the fate of animals is the same. Guess what the fate is? They die. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast. For all is vanity. This is one of his key words throughout this book. All is transient, all is meaningless, all is ludicrous. All has no point. Men die and animals die. So what? As one dies, so dies the other. All go to the same place. Now, do they? Do you believe animals have souls? Solomon doesn't address this issue, but you are challenged to think about this. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust. And that's right out of Genesis. I mean, you couldn't have just quoted it hardly any better than that. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? What makes you think people go to heaven? Solomon says, prove it to me. Prove to me people go to heaven. You can't prove it. You have to believe it by faith. I have seen that nothing is better than man than he should be happy than his lot in life. Just accept your lot in life. Orient to your niche. And this is the highest happiness man can hope for at a certain level. Because if you're running around and you think someday down the road, happiness is this elusive thing and I'm going to get it, you're never going to get it. It doesn't exist. What happiness does exist is the happiness that God gives. And that's another whole thing. Back up to chapter 2 there, at the end of chapter 2. Verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and to drink, and to tell himself that his labor is good. To take pleasure in your life. Your life as it exists. You say, well, I don't like my job. Well, you're in trouble then. Because your job is, in a sense, all you got. Of this I have seen that it is from the hand of God. See, God does this. This is God's plan. People may not like it. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? This rhetorical question basically kind of demands a negative answer. Nobody can. So if God doesn't want you to be happy, can you go make yourself happy? And the answer is no, you can't. You won't be happy if God doesn't want you to be happy. God will jam everything you do. He'll frustrate you to where you'll think suicide is a good option. Well, can God do that? Sure he can. He's God. He can do whatever he wants. And you think somebody answers to no one, it's God. He answers to no one. For to a person who is good in his sight. Now, he doesn't tell you who this person is, but he acknowledges that there are people that God favors. Now, why does God favor them, you might ask? Well, that's a good question. Why does God favor certain people? Why is he down on others? He has given wisdom, knowledge, and joy. And look at what the one he favors gets. He gets intangibles. Wisdom, knowledge, joy. This isn't Escalade, big house, and all the things that go with that. No, he gets the intangibles in life that make life valuable. While to the sinner, and again, sinner here has the idea of the kata there in the Hebrew, the guy who misses the mark. To the person that misses the mark, he gives the task of gathering and collecting. So people go out and they lay up money and the details of life and all that, so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. There's going to be a big redistribution of the wealth in God's plan. People want to say, well, I got mine. Well, that's okay. You got yours, so what? God may take it from you. That's another whole point he makes throughout this. Even if you succeed in life, you can lose it all in a minute. It can all be taken away from you. Well, that's kind of depressing. It can all be taken away from you. I mean, no matter how hard I work and I do this and do that, yeah, you take it away. Ever hear the crash of market in the 29? Ever hear the Great Depression? God can take it in a minute. And so while Solomon just leaves it at that, the question is, well, So what should I do then? Okay, if I work hard, I may not succeed. And even if I do succeed, God can take it from me. And even if I do succeed and God lets me have it, I'm still going to die and lose it anyway. Wow, this is fun. So how is a man to live becomes the question. And this is where Solomon brings his audience to. Okay, so what is there in this life that's worthwhile? What is there that's worth having? What is it that God wants? And he seems to acknowledge the fact that God is remote and mysterious. In fact, he does acknowledge that back in chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 17. God has made everything. And that's another whole thing. God controls the timing of his plan. You don't. And that's this whole, there is an appointed time to everything. Well, who appointed it? God, not you. And the biggest decisions of your life, birth and death, do you have any say-so over? Nope. Not one. You didn't pick to be born. You didn't decide to be born. How did I get here? Those are questions, good questions to ask. Why do I exist? What's this world all about? Why am I here? So there's an appointed time, a time to give birth and a time to die, and you have no control over it. Even the pregnant woman doesn't determine the time of birth. You may have to go in labor for, 18 hours? That has to be fun. Probably not. Or if you're lucky, you get pregnant and birth comes pretty quickly. And you don't have to agonize through it. So verse 11, he has made everything appropriate in its time. There's an appropriate time and a place for everything. And the smart person orients to God's timing. Now, Solomon never comes out and tells you that. But if he tells you there's a sovereign eternal God and he's got a time for everything, what's the logical conclusion to that? Well, I better orient to it. Or I can fight against it, do it my way. Well, okay. He's made everything appropriate to its time. He has also set eternity in their hearts, apart from which a man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning to the end. And then he says in verse 14 at the end of it, for God has so worked it that men should fear him. And the fear of God means exactly that. They'd like to soften it down and say, well, it means reverential awe. And Linda was telling me the other day, I haven't seen it yet, but she said she saw this commercial on Evan Almighty, which I haven't seen the movie, if any of you have. But apparently God appears in this guy's back seat, and the guy's scared to death. And he said, that's what I'm talking about. That is the fear of God. I haven't seen it, but that's funny. That's what God's looking for. He's not impressed with, I think God's okay. God, you better be afraid of God at a certain level. Again, we have a lot of motivations for serving God, and one of the motivations clearly set forth in the Scripture is that we ought to be afraid of what God can do. Because if we don't take him and his plan seriously, God can lower the boom on you in nothing flat. And if he lowers the boom on you, you're going to be blowed up real good. And you're not going to like it. So while Solomon never comes out and says this, he essentially says that men should fear God. I mean, he kind of said, God has worked it so that men should fear him anyway. Now, whether men fear him or not really is up to them, I suppose. But even no matter how smart you are, no matter how much doctrine you got, let me tell you one thing I know about you. That is, you haven't figured God's plan out from the beginning to the end. Nobody has. Nobody will. And so Solomon sets forth in this book very clearly man's limitations, man's needs. And yet, man's needs aren't always fulfilled. Well, why? And the fact is, again, without ever saying it, it goes back to the fall. This was not the way God created the world to be, the way we see it today, based on power and greed and approbation, lust and money and fame and all these other things that people think are so important. This is not the world God envisioned. And this is not, and I can prove that from the book of Revelation, because when we get to when we finish that book there at the end, you saw the world that God envisions is a whole different world than what, we have now. It's a world of no pain, no sorrow, no tears, no death, no separation, no mourning, all those things. Now, are all those things realities now? Absolutely. Absolutely. And in those realities, can we learn anything? That becomes another whole thing. Even as bad as the world is, can we learn anything from it? Well, we can learn that life's pretty unfulfilling sometimes, isn't it? Even if you're the greatest man on the planet. And again, you know, Solomon surpassed the celebrities of today. They're not Britney Spears? That's your celebrity? Paris Hilton? Give me a break. These are the people you look up to? Solomon was so far beyond all that. And he was a wise man. But yet, for all his wisdom, you know, he determined he was going to take some deviations from doctrine and do it his way. Well, if you ask him, if you could ask him, if you could talk to him today, hey, Solomon, how'd that work out for you? He'll tell you, don't do it. Don't do it. I did it. Don't do it. And that's what he says repeatedly throughout this, back in chapter 2. I said to myself, verse 1, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Whoa! What do you got in mind, baby? Anything I can think of. And so Solomon says, enjoy yourself. So he lived the high life, the good life. And you see that on the commercials. Live the high life. He lived the good life to the maximum. All the money, all the wine, all the... Every night was a Vegas show in his house. He had the best comedians, he had the best singers, he had the best dancers. Broadway had nothing on him. Every night it was whatever he wanted. And when you go back and you read just the provision of food for one day in his household, I mean, it's astronomical. You and I couldn't even begin to afford it. And we saw how much gold came to him in a particular year. Something like, I don't remember the figure, I know it's in the notes now, but it was billions of dollars in modern terms. Just in a year. Bill Gates has nothing on him. I don't care how many operating systems you sell, you're never going to be as wealthy as Solomon was. So I said, pleasure. Okay. I'm going to make myself happy. And he tells you how he did it. I explored, verse 3, with my mind, how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely. In other words, I drank to the point, not of drunkenness. I'm sure he got drunk on occasion. I mean, you know, nobody's that good at it. I'm just going to drink right up to the point, right before I'm drunk and stop. Well, good luck on that one. That doesn't work out all the time, trust me. I know whereof I speak on this one. The reality is, of course he got drunk. That just sends the funny spinning when they read this. Well, Solomon didn't drink to drunkenness. Yes, he did. Good Lord. No, he stopped right at that. Yeah. I've never met a man that did that perfectly. Anybody here? Never been drunk? Not once? Yeah, well, good luck. He said, I did wine. I did, whatever. And if he had access to chemicals, he would have done chemicals too. Say, well, Solomon wouldn't have done that. Sure, he would have. He's a king, for God's sake. Who's he going to answer to? Solomon, you shouldn't be eating those mushrooms. Your face is melting, man. I can't hear. He would not have denied himself anything. And if you think he would have, you've misread Solomon. And he says that. I went out and I did everything I could. And I built the greatest menageries you've ever seen. I built the greatest zoos. I built the greatest parks. You go find the most manicured park. You got to go to Busch Gardens or, well, I don't know where the big parks are. You know, they got them all around. But pick one. Go to it. And look at it and be awed and go, ooh. And Solomon's would have blown you away. His would have been so far beyond what you see today, even. And I built vineyards. I made gardens and parks. I made pools of water. I mean, you know, you see people that landscape and manicure their lawns and do all this and that. Like my brother-in-law, he's got this house. I mean, it's just to die for. Everything's perfect. It's manicured. He's retired, and he's got all this time. Does these little bonsai trees, and everything's perfect. I mean, as perfect as you can get it, just about. I mean, anytime I go there, he lives in Oklahoma, I see him, I'm just like, wow. Very impressive. Remodeled his house, did it all himself, hardwood floors, remodeled everything. I mean, it's just a Better Homes and Gardens showcase. And Solomon's, believe me, it would have blown this away. And I've seen some pretty nice stuff in my life. And you can't imagine what Solomon saw every day. He took it for granted. It was all his. I bought male and female slaves. Flocks and herds. I collected silver and gold. I was the richest man, by the way, that ever lived. He surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches, wealth, and fame. So, he didn't have, you know, can you imagine how famous Solomon would be today with modern media? Most powerful man in the world. Every year it's Solomon.
So I collected all this, male singers and female singers. And believe me, he didn't get Wayne Newton to come in.
When I say Vegas show, I don't want you to think tacky. He had good singers. He had Pavarotti.
He had the Rockettes times 10, if you can imagine that. And the pleasures of men. Oh, yeah, what's that? Sex.
Oh, I had concubines. 700 wives with 300 concubines. That's 1,000 women. Even at one a day. You don't have to be with the same woman but once every 3 years. Wow. Maybe there's something to... No, obviously not. But did that make him happy? No. He had everything everybody would think would make you happy. And people think different stuff. I'd be happy if I had another woman. Well, he had 1,000 of them.
I'd be happy if I could go here and do that.
He went wherever he wanted and did whatever he wanted. I'd be happy if I had more money. He had more money than God. And wasn't happy. I'd be happy if people just recognized me and asked me for my autograph. God, that gets old quick. Have you ever seen how fast that gets? Watch these celebrities. Can you give me your autograph? Sure. And I thought about that. I remember when I was a little kid, you know, we went down to the Oklahoma City Fairgrounds to watch championship wrestling. And I got the autograph of the heavyweight champion at that time. Wrestling's real when you're a kid. I don't care what you say. When you're a kid, it's real. And I get this autograph, and I keep it, and I keep it as a treasure. And I finally looked at it one day, I thought, what am I going to do with this? And I thought, well, why do people collect all these autographs? What's it do for them? Am I going to sell it on eBay? You know? So Solomon had it all. Had all the fame. Hey, Solomon, give me your autograph. He probably just did an S. Would it look like this in the Hebrew?
Yep.
There you go. Sholomon. So, he has all this. It doesn't make him happy. And he bemoans the fact that even if he does succeed in life, which he did, then he bemoans the fact that, oh my God, I'm going to die. And guess what? And he looked at this from every angle, by the way. If you go to chapter 2, verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom, insanity, and folly. Well, maybe the insane person knows something we don't know. Maybe they've got a better take on this than we have. You know, they show movies where the insane person kind of seems like the normal. You see One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest? You begin to think the insane guy is actually more sane than the rest of the world. The inmates are literally running the asylum. And but he explored all this carefully, checked it all out. Oh, maybe the wise man knows something. All right, I'll check out wisdom. Well, maybe the fool knows something. Maybe the fool's really better off than we think he is. The fool doesn't concern himself with much. Maybe that's a better way to live. Solomon said, no, that's not satisfying either. So I said, one fate, verse 15, as the fate of the fool, it's going to befall me. So why have I been extremely wise? Have I just wasted my time by doing all this? And so he says, and I mean, he is depressed. He is clinically depressed by the time he gets through with all this. Verse 17, so I hated life, for all the work which had been undone under the sun was grievous to me. Verse 18, I hated all the fruit of my labor. He had these elaborate parks and zoos and all this stuff. And he looked at it and he just said, I hate it. Can't stand it. So what's all your success worth? Nothing. That's the bottom line. And then what does he say? I must leave it to the man who comes after me, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. I'm going to die and leave. And he, by the way, Rehoboam was probably, I'm thinking, in his 30s by this time. And Solomon probably knew his son was an idiot. That's always great as a parent to know that, to come to that conclusion. Oh, my son's an idiot. Well, Solomon probably knew. And he knew that everything he worked for, everything he did, he was going to leave to this idiot. And there's every chance that you'll leave your stuff to an idiot too. There's every chance of that.
And will they have any capacity? Oh, you worked hard all your life. You denied yourself all these things. You got this big savings account, got this retirement account, got this insurance policy and all this, and you're going to die and you're going to leave it, and what's the person going to do? They may go out and squander it within a week. Squander it all. Everything you work for could be gone within weeks. Well, how's that make you feel? Bad. I feel bad. Well, this is where Solomon's at in his thinking. These are the kinds of things he's thought through and went through and says, okay, here's what the reality of the world is, if you want to know it. Well, most people don't like thinking about this kind of stuff. Well, this is depressing. Hell yes, it's depressing. It's supposed to be. So what is the purpose of life? Is there any happiness to be had? Or is it all just misery and depression? You know, the old deal off of Hee Haw, gloom, despair, and agony on me. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Well, that's some people's philosophy, I guess. But the question becomes, is that Solomon's philosophy? Is that really what he believes nowadays, we might say? So he said, this all is vanity. He's going to have all the fruit of my labor. I was wise. I handled all this great. And guess what? You'll hand it over to an idiot, very possibly. So there you go. And people don't like thinking about this stuff. You look in chapter 7. We're going to get a little ahead here. But what does he say? Verse 2. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. Why? Because that is the end of every man. You know where every one of us is going to end up absent the rapture? Funeral home. So let's go down to the funeral home and hang out and see what lessons we can learn from life. We can interview the corpse. How's it going? Not so good. Not so good, really. Well, how much money do you have? Oh, 30 million. How much you got now? None. Where'd you live? Out on Longboat Key. Nice house. Right on the Gulf. Beautiful view. How's that make you feel now? Not so good. So how'd it go for you? What can we learn from going to the house of mourning? That everybody's going to end up there. That's the end of every man. And people don't like thinking about death. And so they do everything they can to fill their life, to fill the emptiness, because they don't want to think about the weight of your matter and the fact that I'm going to die. And why is Solomon doing this? Because he's trying to teach the younger generation something. Hey, you're mortal too. How did you feel like, I've told this story before, but I remember when I was like 8 or 9 or 10, you know, summer seemed endless. You get out of school 3 months, that was forever. The most glorious 3 months of your life. And it just was wonderful. Then you grow up and you find out there is no 3-month summer vacation. I think we might be teaching her kids the wrong thing. They'd be better off going to school year-round, I guess. I don't know. But it seemed endless. And then, you know, and I didn't concern myself with death or dying or any of that stuff. It didn't bother me. Why would I worry about that? And so Solomon's trying to tell the younger generation, hey, you better recognize you're going to die too. You're mortal, just like I am. I'm an old guy. Well, old guys die, sure. Young people die too. They die every day. You know. So he says, look at this. Here's what you ought to focus on. People don't want to focus on this. And now let's get to our verses here, just to give you get back up to speed here. And now he's going to bemoan the oppression of politics. Well, we don't have that in our world, do we? We're just running around making the world safe for democracy by blowing them up. You know when you're in trouble is when the U.S. shows up and says, we're here to make peace. Yeah. Good luck on that one. If you see, and by the way, another reason for this whole book is to inform his younger audience, if you're going to see certain things in life, I'm telling you right now, you're going to see them. Just as sure as the sun comes up in the morning, you're going to see politics and oppression. And it's going to happen. If you see the oppression of the poor, that doesn't happen in our world, does it?
Yeah.
And the denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. What's the first instinct? Wow, this is bad. If here you got the hypothetical particle im, I am, if.
And the accusative's actually following the Hebrew. The verb doesn't come quite a ways down the line. So, but just to tell you, I've changed the order here. Just you see, because it's smoother English word order. You got the cal imperfect, second masculine, singular, ra'ah. R-A, apostrophe A-H. If you will see, or if you will observe. And the hypothetical here is not necessarily hypothetical. You're going to see it, is what he's saying, but in a subtle way, I think. If you see, then you've got the masculine, singular, noun construct here of a shek. I think I left a vowel point off of there. S-H-E-Q. E-S-H-E-Q. The verbal root denotes the abuse of authority or power by burdening, oppressing, or crushing those of lower station. Those most likely to be oppressed, of course, were those who, just in our society, didn't have the money to protect their rights. The widow, the orphan, the foreigner, or the poor. And in many cases, this word is used, when you go check it out, it has to do with financial robbery or extortion. Blackmail, essentially. Oppressing them financially is the idea of it. You're going to see poor people in the world get the dirty end of the stick a lot of times. And this is just the way the world works. You can bemoan it all you want. Some might ask, well, why didn't Solomon fix all these injustices? He was the king. Well, even the king can't fix everything in this world, in this broken down world. And I think Solomon was smart enough to know also, you're not here to fix the devil's world. At a certain level, there's only so much anyone can do. And again, as we were talking on break, if you take some of these doctrines that people teach seriously, how do you even sleep at night? All of the poor, we've got to feed the poor. And you're going to hear about it all this month, of course, because this is the time of year we've got to concern ourselves. You'll have to see the bell ringers, and you've got to fix the poor. Well, the poor you have with you always. You can't fix everything. And at a certain level, as a believer, this is where doctrine is really liberating to me. Oh, it's not my job to fix the world. That's a big job, fixing the world. I mean, how are you going to do that? First, you'd have to start with the court system, and that's a big job all by itself. So you see this. You see people abuse their authority, and they crush those under them financially, just because they can. So if you see the oppression of the poor, the cal participle here is used substantively here, rush, R-U-S-H. And that just simply means to be poor or destitute. Or the denial of justice. Gazel, G-A-Z-E-L in the Hebrew. Six times this is used. The verb refers to the practice of violently robbing people. This is the noun. Taking their goods or tearing things off by force. Here used of the ripping apart of justice. So you're going to see the justice system take a beating. OJ. Enough said, right? Why do the celebrities in this world commit the same crimes as poor people, but they aren't punished the same? Because they're celebrities. And God help us. And then when they do decide to make an example out of somebody, Michael Vick, he didn't kill anybody, did he? He killed a dog. It's a dog, for goodness sake. I'm not saying you should abuse animals. Don't get me wrong. You shouldn't. The Bible makes it plain the righteous man has regard for the life of his beast. We got murderers walking free and dog fighters in prison. Does this seem right to you? There's something wrong here. Something very wrong. So here, if you see the ripping apart of justice, or judgment, mishpat, M-I-S-P-S-H-P-H-A-T, mishpat, actually. And I'm sorry, it's a hard P there. If you see the ripping apart of justice and righteousness is tzedek, that word means right or what is right or rectitude, do not be shocked at the sight. In the province, I'm sorry, you got the inseparable preposition bait here attached to the word Medina. M-E-D-I-N-A-H. The basic meaning here is an administrative district. A legal jurisdiction or a province. We have legal jurisdictions in the United States. You have city jurisdiction, county jurisdiction, state jurisdiction, and then federal. And they each have their jurisdiction. So
do not be shocked. And again, here you have what would normally be immediate prohibition, the negative ad, with the cal imperfect jussive. And again, the jussive is imperatival in force of tamah. T-A-M-A-H. Nine times the word means to be astonished, astounded, dumbfounded, or bewildered. You'll probably know what that emotion is. You may not be able to articulate it, but you know what it's like when you see something and you're just like, huh? Don't let your jaw drop if you see this, because you're going to see it. And again, immediate prohibition would be stop letting your jaw drop. Stop being astonished. For one official watches over another official. Ah, there's a chain of command here. I see. What do you know? In the establishment chain here, there's a command. Over, literally, do not be shocked at the sight or at the occurrence, literally. You got the preposition ale again, plus here the masculine singular noun of kephets. C-H-E-P-H-E-T-S. Again, the word means that which delights or pleases. In Ecclesiastes, it appears to be used in a more general sense of that which occurs, that which comes to pass. Obviously, we wouldn't say injustice is something that would be pleasing to see. For one official, introductory conjunction here, or explanatory, key, because one official is Gavoa, G-A-B-H-O-A-H. Comes from, this word means to be high or lofty. It's used of places, like a high place, being up on a mountain, all that. And it's used of arrogant attitudes. We'll see that in Ecclesiastes 7:8. Here, it's used of a lofty position, a higher lofty, an exalted position in the government. Because one official, one lofty official, we might say, and then you got the preposition mean here with the preposition ale, literally from above or over, and then you got gavoa again, one official over another official. And then you got a cal active participle of shamar, which means to keep watch or guard, S-H-A-M-A-R, to exercise care or authority over. Because one official over another official, watching, literally, cal participle there, watching or guarding or exercising authority, and an official, again, gavoa again, over them, you got the preposition ale with the third masculine plural suffix. So everybody answers to somebody is kind of the deal here. So how are you going to fix it? And the question becomes, of course, now why is he saying this? And we'll get to that in the explanation. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. I've got actually a corrected translation here, one of the few verses I've actually corrected. And I think it's more to the point and expresses what the verse is getting at. And the corrected translation is, however, it is an advantage for everyone in the territory to have a king for the cultivated fields. So when you see oppression and injustice in the establishment chain of command, what's people's knee-jerk reflex? Throw them out. Get rid of them. Authority must be bad because it's abused. Well, that's stupid. So Solomon's going to counter with, well, there's a need for authority, though. There's a need for the establishment chain of command. Even when it's abused, there's still a need for it to be there. Because other than that, you have anarchy. And then every man just does what's right in his own eyes. Well, that's just chaos. So Solomon says, look, however, you got a wow here plus the term yithron, which actually means that which is left over, that which is an excess, that which is a profit, hence an advantage. However, it's an advantage to the land. Feminine singular noun of eretz. Here, the idea, Solomon does appear to use this later to refer to a limited portion of land, not the entire earth. So that's, sometimes this word's translated earth. It means the whole world, but it's not. I don't think it is in this case. So a territory, however, it is an advantage to everyone in the territory. You have the inseparable preposition bait plus the masculine singular noun of kol, all, each, or everyone. It is, as a feminine a pronoun here, third feminine singular, he, which actually acts as a copula, which is like a to be verb in the Hebrew. This is a regular usage of this pronoun, in fact. However, it's an advantage
for everyone in the territory, or administrative district, a province, you know, whatever, however you want to translate it there, to have a king. Melech. Now, who's the highest official in all the land? These authorities in the establishment chain of command, pardon me, all answer to somebody else. There's a lower official who answers to a higher official, 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 and then there's the king. And so he says, ultimate authority needs to be there. This is, he's countering, because people would generally tend to say, okay, you're going to see oppression. Well, again, let's just get rid of it. Well, you can't. That's the whole point here. However, it is an advantage to everyone in the land to have a king. For the cultivated fields is preposition lamed, with the masculine singular noun of shadeh, or S-A, I'm sorry, it's sadeh, it's no, S-A-D-E-H. And that word means a field or a country. It's used of open country, used of portions of the country that were used for pasture, for instance, grazing land. It's also used of like gardens and crops, lands like that. And then you've got the Nifal perfect here, a third masculine singular of avad, A-B-H-A-D-H. And that word means being worked, literally. The Nifal is passive. The fields being worked, which would be, again, in my opinion, the cultivated fields, the fields being cultivated. Why do you need establishment chain of command? It keeps peace in the country. There is a civil order that is established and maintained because we have governing officials. Now, are they imperfect? Absolutely. Do they make mistakes? Absolutely. Do they abuse their authority? Absolutely. Do they take bribes and kickbacks? Absolutely. And so given that, you might say, well, then why do we have it? Because let me tell you one thing else they do. They put criminals in jail. They keep aggressors out of the country. That's part of the reason for having it. That's a legitimate reason for the military, is to protect us from external aggressors. And that's part of the legitimate function of the establishment chain of command. The military is fine. And a part of what they do is also, in the establishment chain of command, is they maintain civil order. Isn't that in our Constitution to ensure domestic tranquility? Isn't that part of it? And so we pay taxes to these people. Why? I don't want the robber at my house, do you? I don't want the rapist in my neighborhood. You know, I don't want the murderer on my streets. And so part of the deal is you're going to see oppression, you're going to see abuse. But if you throw the whole system out, and this is what people are prone to do, they want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. And by the way, I was reading something. That's an interesting expression, and there's a reason why that expression came into existence. I won't tell you today. But there is a reason for that. I might tell you at lunch or something. But the idea is that, okay, if we throw it all out, then what do we got? We're going to have chaos and anarchy. And this is why the rights of the people, this is the Laodicean church age period in which we live, the rule of the people. People want to rise up and they want to run things. The people have proven themselves unable to run things. Again, you just end up with the inmates running the asylum. And you have to have a certain amount of authority, both spiritually and physically, in order to ensure safety for people. Positive volition is the big thing. And that's why we're told that, in fact, that God set up, he established nationalism as a function in Acts 17 there. Paul says, look, he established nations. Why? Because it's a protection for positive volition. See, authority is there to protect the innocent. That's the reason they're there. To protect the innocent and punish the guilty. That's why we have authority. And the reality is, of course, people say, well, their authority is abused sometimes. Yes, it is. Now, you shouldn't. Ideally, we strive not to. But even if people fail, guess what? The system is there for a reason. And God established this system, by the way. And Solomon says, well, is the system flawed? You read the verse, well, sure, it's flawed. Why? Because there's imperfect men in it. You show me a perfect system, and I'll show you it's got to be run by perfect people. When will we have perfect justice? When you have a perfect judge. That'll be during the millennium. It'll be Jesus Christ, who will reign from Jerusalem. And again, in the Oriental monarchy, the king was also the judge. There was no separation of powers like we have in our Constitution. You don't have the executive and the legislative and the judicial. The king was all that.
He was the executive, the legislative, and judicial. He made laws. And he laid them down and he enforced them. And it was his call. And if he was a righteous king, well, God obviously blessed him and blessed his culture and all that. Okay, well, we're not going to dive into this today, but that'll get us started with the exposition, or at least the exegesis of it. And we'll deal with the explanation of it on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.